And welcome to the Investor Coaching Show. Paul Winkler, talking about the world of money investing. And having been at a financial conference, I'll have some things to share. You know, some things that the conversations around the room can be pretty interesting when you go to those things. For me, anyway, I like it. I enjoy hanging out with people that do what I do around the country and just hearing their perspectives on things. And this was no different. Got out there, got to talking to some people, and you know, one of the topics of conversation, I'll talk about a few things that we were talking about, but I had some people asking me questions and, you know, got into lots of conversations with people out there. One of the things we talked a little bit about, and I'm going to start off the show just talking about, is we're talking about robotic portfolios. One of the topics that came up, the robotic portfolios, one person actually said robo-advisors, and he says, you know, I didn't hate to call them advisors because there wasn't a whole lot of advising going on, and you know, to some extent that can be true, but you know, there are these companies out there that are adding certified financial planners in there that you can get access to, and the problem is that the way they're actually put together, and the reason I don't use any of them in our practice, there are lots of reasons that I don't use any of them in our practice. And I'll get into it. You know, I've seen people with 401ks where they say, hey, should we hire the 401k? They got this advisor, and should we use them for it? And I said, no, don't. Because I actually have seen how they actually manage the portfolios, and I'm not impressed. But I'll talk to you why. I don't ever tell you something unless I tell you why I'm not for it in these particular cases, because they're saying, they're going, hey, we're going to watch this, we're going to keep an eye on your portfolio and all of that. And tell me, there are things that you can do. I would rather, I'll go straight to the punch and say, you know, what I would rather see somebody do is select funds themselves in the 401ks and then just rebalance them on a regular basis. And rather than have somebody in there going and doing it, because the problem is you don't know what they're doing. And that's what that's the gist of what I want to start off with. What is it that's actually going on behind the scenes that you don't know? You know, because they're really being marketed pretty heavily on low cost. Matter of fact, there was a good article in the New York Times about this. You know, getting free trading, low cost, and there's often a catch. Yeah, there are lots of catches. A friend of mine sent me this article. And it was talking about low-cost investing isn't always as cheap as it appears. Many companies stamping out certain fees are doing other things that can cost you money. And it's up to you, dear investor, I like the way they put that, to figure out what they are. And it's up to me, Paul Winkler, to tell you what some of these things are. Because you won't even know it. You won't realize it's happening. They're cutting costs in all kinds of crazy ways. And, you know, it's not free by any stretch of the imagination. It is lower cost than a lot of the other things out there, but that's only visible expenses that are lower. It's really, matter of fact, I'm not going to share the numbers on the show because I'm going to actually do this in a workshop for clients in January, and I'm actually going to be going to Houston and going to be teaching a workshop to a big get together out there and going to be talking about these numbers. So, you know, I figured what I would do for if you're a client of our firm, you know, Goodlettsville location. And if you really want to, there's got to be some way I can get you all involved in this thing. Let other people that are in other offices around, maybe we'll talk to some of the other advisors. I'll spring it upon them. But very, very interesting taking some of these portfolios, the lowest cost ones and the lowest cost providers out there. And I went back 20 years. And I actually looked at, well, what if you had taken these portfolios, and I did many different companies, and actually had taken an income from them, what would you end up with today if you followed the 4% rule? And that was the whole idea. So it's because people talk about, you know, you got the 4% rule. If you can take 4% of your investment value, so if you got $1 million, you take out $40,000. The next year, you got inflation, so maybe you're taking out $41,000 the next year and increase it each year for inflation. What would have happened? In every single case, it was a huge negative number. I mean, you ended up with a much lower number. And I was telling some of the advisors I was talking to, I said, no wonder the investment industry is running away from the 4% rule. Why? Because it hasn't worked. Why? Because they didn't follow the dictates of academics and investing. Why? It has to do with marketing, which sounds so weird. Why is it that, you know, that marketing has anything to do with this. Well, it has everything to do with what you will put up with as an investor and what you will do and what you think you want. And what ends up happening is the investment management ends up being more of an order-taking type of thing. For example, and one of the examples that those of you, the clients of mine, you've probably heard me say this before, but let's say if you look at portfolios that are robotically managed or where the fund company chooses all the funds, and target date funds fall into this category as well. What they'll do is this. They will hold more of the areas of the market that are least expensive to manage. Why? Because one of the things that sells in regards to investing is super low cost. Well, if you want to keep the cost extremely low, what do you got to do? You got to figure out how to cut costs of management. How do you do that? Manage areas of the market that are super easy to access, like large U.S. stocks. And if you do that, you know, you're going to be looking more like the Dow and the S&P 500 or a total market portfolio like Vanguard does. That's what they use. They use a total market portfolio. And most of the companies in there are going to be very big U.S. companies because it's just really cheap to buy and sell and trade those companies. Well, what happens is that let's say that you talk to the average person on the street and you say, hey, what did the market do today? What are they going to come back with? Well, they may have heard a report on TV, radio, somebody, some talking head saying, well, the Dow is, you know, went up 25 points today, went up 100 points, went down 50 points today. They're going to tell you what the Dow did, right? Maybe they'll be able to remember what the S&P 500 did or what the NASDAQ did. I did a whole video on this on my website, paulwinkler.com, and I talked about common indices and how much they had in common. I mean, it's literally the same stocks. You know, why report on any more than one indice when they all own the same stuff? You can go into the education center on my website, Learning Center, and you can actually pull up the videos that I've done in the past. And by the way, Michael is doing an unbelievable job and redoing some of our videos, and we're actually updating the look of these things. So check it out. But anyway. So what happens is that if you ask this person, hey, what did the Dow, the NASDAQ, or the S&P 500 do? They're going to tell you what it did. And let's say that you own a mutual fund or you own an investment account, and the manager of that investment account, let's say that the Dow went way up, and you look at your portfolio and you go, oh, look, went way up. You know, I've had a good year. It's gone up as much as the Dow or the S&P 500. Is their job safe? Yes, I would submit that their job is safe. You're not going to get rid of them or fire them because, hey, they're getting the returns of what the market did, and you've been hearing great stuff, and you're excited about it. Now, on the other hand, if the market goes down and the fund goes down or the investment account goes down that they're managing, what are you hearing from everybody? Well, that's all anybody talks about is that area of the market. So you're hearing, well, the market's down, and what you need to do as an investor is be disciplined. Don't sell out, which is true. You know, you don't want to sell out when markets are down. But the issue is this. You went up and you went down, and here's what they're basically looking at. Is their job safe? Because remember what their job is. Their job is to keep their job. And if the market goes down and the fund goes down, the account goes down a like amount, your job is safe. So they're good with that. They're good with either one of those scenarios. If you have a situation where, let's say, the Dow is way up and the account is not up, it's only up a fraction of that amount, is their job safe? No. With most investors, they would be thinking, what an idiot. I can't believe it. They're really bad. They're terrible at managing money. They're fired. You're out of here. And it's because most investors don't have a clue. You know, really, when you're looking at an investment portfolio, that diversification means, and they should know this. I mean, you know this intuitively. You've heard it before. But because most of our decisions as investors are emotional in nature, you know, there's a Meyer Statman is an economist, and he talks a lot about psychology in investing. And he talks about how much of our decision making around investing is psychological in nature. And his answer, 100% of it. So when you have, let's say, large U.S. stocks doing really, really well, and let's just go back to the idea of diversification. What is it by definition? Don't put all your eggs in basket, right? Don't put it in the same basket. Why? Because one basket could come crumbling down and all the eggs are broken, and then you've got no eggs left, right? That's the basic idea behind it. Well, here's a more basic look at it, because they don't get dropped at the same time, or if you're talking about baskets, but markets don't move together. You can have periods of time where large U.S. stocks do nothing, absolutely nothing. You can have a couple 20-year periods in the last century and a 10-year period so far this century, and where there was absolutely no movement whatsoever after inflation, basically negative in this century. And the rate of return after inflation, even the whole century so far, as well as the U.S. stocks have done recently, the return has been pretty abysmal, really, up to this point in the time in the century. But people look at the last couple of years, and they, because of recency bias, because of what's happened recently, they feel pretty good about it. But let's say that you're diversified, and you own all of these different areas of the market, and the Dow is doing better than that. People look at it and go, whoa, wait a minute, this is terrible. Diversification is the stupidest thing ever. And then they just want to get out, right? And that's human behavior. Well, rather than buck human behavior, the investment managers of these types of portfolios, and I've been looking at a lot of them and seeing the same exact thing. It's just like, well, gee, everybody's doing the same thing. It's like lemmings, running off the cliff together. Actually, I've heard that's a myth, but anyway. but you look at them, you go, wow, they're all doing the same thing. Now, here's the fourth scenario. The market goes way down and the portfolio goes up. Now, all of a sudden, you're a genius. Now, here's the reality for investment managers. They know that they don't have that ability. They know that they can't do that consistently. So shooting for that scenario, forget about it. I'm not going to shoot for trying to beat the market or trying to, time it and get out when the market's going to go down and get in before the market goes up, because that's a loser's game, and it is. Studies have shown that there's one study of 91 pension plans, and every single one of them engaged in the behavior. Every single one of them. Not one of them increased returns as a result of their activity. So it's a loser's game, and everybody knows it. So they will wipe that out and say, forget it, we're not going to do that. We're not going to try to, if the market goes down, we're going to be the hero, and we're going to make money, because that would be luck, if anything, if it happened. So what happens is this. They are much more prone to look like the market. If the S&P and the Dow go up and they're up with it, cool, job safe. Market goes down, cool, job safe. So that is what happens in the investment management, is they typically do that. Now, the other thing that they'll do is this. They may do that, and they'll do a little bit of market timing. Now, they don't do blatant market timing, but they do, and it's a lot of it is psychological in nature why they do it. They will do what's called tactical asset allocation. Now, tactical asset allocation is where you'll shift the portfolio a little bit. You'll shift it and put a little bit more money in what seems to be promising. And I was looking at this earlier today, where I was going through, one of the things I like to do around this time of year is I look at, hey, what are people saying about 2020? What are they saying about the year ahead? And you have somebody ask me this week, hey, Paul, I saw this thing, Vanguard released their 2020 economic and market report outlook. Should I listen to it? I was like, absolutely not. And as a brand new client, hasn't really gone through much training yet or education yet. And just said, should I listen to this? I said, no, do not. Because if somebody is putting this out, and it's not just them, I mean, UBS, Investor Watch, they called the 2020 a year of choices, a decade of transformation. They said, you're going to seek returns in a year of choices and look forward to investment opportunities in a decade of transfer, blah, 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 blah. And T. Rowe Price has, investment professionals share global outlook for 2020 financial markets. And then you got, nearly 40 analysts say that the global economy is about to worsen, blah, blah, blah. That's what Barron says. And then Morgan Stanley. They see U.S. as a laggard in 2020 across markets. So you have all these different investment firms out there telling you what they think is going to happen in the year ahead. Well, if they're sitting there watching and talking about what they think is going to happen in the year ahead, do you think that maybe in their investment management, they might be prone to act on what their own predictions are? I would say yes. So therefore, would they be prone to trying to time the market in this minute way, tactical asset allocation, not timing it, you know, as it being 100% cash, 100% stocks. Yes. Why would you even, you won't hear me talk about what I think the market's going to do in 2020. You won't ever hear those words out of my mouth. Matter of fact, the closest anybody ever got to me doing it, I was joking with them. Person from the media called me up. I said, hey, Paul, you know, what do you think the market's going to do over the next year? And I said, which market? And she goes, oh, the S&P 500. Well, of course. I said, oh, 10%. Because historically, that's the rate of return back to 1920s, right? That's 10%. I didn't tell her that's why. I just said that. And she goes, oh, okay. She was like, wow. Now, reality is, how many years was the actual return 10% from 1926 till now? Pretty much almost never. Like 1 or 2 years out of you know, 90 years was it ever that. So it doesn't happen very often. Then she said, well, she goes, well, what? Oh, wow, okay, well, you kind of answered that quickly. What do you think is going to happen over the next 6 months? Well, I took 10 divided by 2. I said 5%. And she wasn't really catching on to what I was doing. And then I said, then she said, well, what do you think of the next 3 months? And I said, 2.5%. And then she caught on. But, you know, she was trying to get me to predict the future. And I just laugh at that kind of thing because it's just ridiculous, you know, to get me. Because I have a crystal ball in my office, but it's a joke. I mean, you look into the crystal ball, you look into it deeply, as I tell people to do. They'll look at the bottom and they go, oh, it says, heck, I don't know. And that's my view of the whole thing. You know, so what happens is, you know, that they're all over the place as in asset management because of the fact, because if they can just, let's say they own a little bit more of the asset category that just happens to do better over the next year, then they can brag about their great performance and then they can advertise that and tell you how great they are, you see? And you know, that's the problem they run into. And then you also see in the management of these portfolios, consumer funds, retail funds, which I'm not a real big fan of using a heck of a lot of retail funds, and because they're just more costly because of what other investors do in them. That's a whole other segment for a long segment for another time. And then a lot of times you'll see this. They'll use trendy asset categories. Like I'll see them slip in socially conscious funds or energy funds or commodity funds or gold funds or, whatever appeals to the investor because they're hearing about it in the media and they want to appear that they're on top of things. There's actually a concept in investing called window dressing, where a fund company will add stocks that have been hot during the quarter at the end of the quarter just to show that they own them. Now, of course, they didn't own them when they were doing well, but they own them at the end of the quarter, and it looks really good, right? You know, so it's just these games. But younger investors are really attracted to this stuff. Why? Because they don't know what they're getting. You know, they really don't understand this stuff, and they think, oh, robotic, internet-based, oh, I can sign up and do this online, and I don't have to talk to a human because then it's great, you know, that, or, you know, if I don't have to talk to anybody I know or, you know, whatever. I don't know what the deal is. But, you know, that it's something that, and they've never been tested by a market downturn. So what happens is when you see a big market downturn upcoming, I'm going to be, it's interesting because last time we had a big market downturn, tons of money flowed out of these types of accounts at the worst periods in time, and their lines got jammed up, and they couldn't answer all the phone calls. So, you know, there are all kinds of problems as to why I don't recommend this stuff. But anyway, that was one of the topics of conversation at one of the financial workshops. And like I said, I think that would be a great topic. I'll talk to my staff about setting up something for clients that listen to the show, because you guys are really engaged in this stuff and you would find it very, very interesting to actually look at the real numbers, as far as what happens when these portfolios are put to the test. Paul Winkler, you're listening to the Investor Coaching Show. I'm going to take a quick break and be right back after this on SuperTalk 99.7 WTN. Welcome back to the Investor Coaching Show. I'm Paul Winkler. Tis the season. And it's also, of course, those of you would know that there's lots of stuff going on today. Pearl Harbor Day. A lot of activities going on around commemorating What a day in history. I don't know. I don't know if you guys ever seen Midway. Went to see that movie with my son. Man, that was really, really good. If you're into World War II, I just love World War II stuff. I just find it absolutely fascinating. You know, just a time in our history that where everybody just came together and for a common cause, and just a phenomenal movie. I really, really enjoy it. I almost didn't go because I was looking at the reviews from the critics, and they said, well, it's not so great. The acting's blah, 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 blah. And I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to go anyway, because you look at the critics and you're like, ah, they give it a 6 out of 10 or something like that. But people that went to it, actually 9 out of 10 is what they thought of it. And I would agree with the other people that went to it. Maybe I'm not a great critic of acting or anything, but I'm telling you, I thought it was great. Really, really enjoyed it a whole lot. So another day to just think about for our military veterans and the folks that are still around from World War II. An amazing time in our history. And okay, so Popeyenomics. Oh, you know what? I probably ought to save that one. I probably ought to save that one. Oh, no, I'll start off and talk a little bit about it. This is fascinating. I was a fan of Popeye when I was a kid. That and Superman, just thinking about when I was young, running around the house with a cape on. But Popeye was on. My mother would, that's the way to get me to eat spinach. You get me to eat spinach, just talk about Popeye, and I'm all over the spinach. why do we do what we do? There was a guy named Richard Robb. Now, and there was this guy that was lobbing pencils at him, as how they start off the article. And the guy that was lobbing pencils at him ended up going on to win the Nobel Prize. And Mr. Robb, who was a doctoral candidate in economics, he was at the University of Chicago. A lot of the research on investing goes back to the University of Chicago, the Center for Research in Securities Prices. And when he was up there, he was at a blackboard, and he was chalking out this idea that he had, and he was studying under an economist who won the Nobel in economics 18 years earlier. And a lot of Nobel Prize winners out there, you know, and some of the guys that I've studied under have come from there. One of them ended up going on to win the Nobel as well. This guy that was throwing pencils at him thought Mr. Robb was wrong on something that he was postulating. And what happened, he's throwing pencils and all this, and I'll come back to that in a second because it actually refers back to it. But he was ignoring this, and he kept writing on the blackboard, and he says, you know, it turns out that he ended up being right. Right about what? Well, he wrote this book called Willful, How We Choose What We Do. And it's really, really interesting because how do we make decisions? You know, think about it. How do you make financial decisions? How do you make decisions when it comes to investing? How do you make decisions in life, in anything? And that's what he was looking at. And this was published by Yale University Press. And the book is aiming to humanize the central idea of what we call neoclassical economics. And this is the idea. I was an economics major, so this is very familiar to me. The idea that we always make decisions based on rational choice. You know, what we do is we look out for our best interest. And we think that we're doing that all the time, don't we? I think every time we make a decision, I think this is going to be the best thing for me and the best thing for us. And we weigh all these things. And the idea that rational choice has faced resistance is this one-size-fits-all theory, you know, because people are going, well, maybe it's not necessarily always that way. And a lot of the people that have actually come up against this are what we call behavioral economists. And I talk about that on the show a lot, where you have these people that talk about behavior and how that affects investors, especially because we tend to do this. As I talked about in the last segment, we look at what's done well recently, right? Or what we do is we have hindsight bias. I knew that this was going to happen. You know, in hindsight, we always seem to be right about stuff, right? I knew that stock was going to do this. I knew this area of the market was going to do this. I knew that international stocks would come crumbling down. I knew that U.S. stocks would come crumbling down. I knew that tech bubble was going to happen. I knew that real estate was blah, blah, blah. You know, we look at hindsight, and then we basically tell ourselves how smart we are. And then confirmation bias is another one, and neuroframing bias. And there are all these different types of biases that make us make really bad decisions as investors. And we don't think about it a whole lot because it's all subconscious, but they're biases nonetheless. So these behavioral economists will come in and say, yeah, your behavior, it's driven by, you know, people, you know, what we end up doing psychologically. And there's all kinds of really interesting things that even in, I was seeing this one thing this week, and they were talking about these things on the internet where you think you're seeing one thing, and then they show you that your brain is actually tricking you. And it's fascinating how that happens. Lots of them out there. Well, what happens is that we tend to make these decisions based on these biases. And he says, maybe there's even something different going on. And he says, the article says, this idea of purposeful choice can explain many things, but not everything. That's where the idea of the book comes from, of certain actions, he says, are undertaken by people not for any tangible benefit, but for their own sake. And to put it like a kid would put it, you know, it's basically, why'd you do that? Well, just because. You know, I just did it because, you know, I just felt like doing it. I don't know why I did it. And that's why I use the Popeye example. I am what I am, right? That's all that I am. And that's kind of the idea behind it. And he ties the incident with pencils. And he says, you know, his guy's throwing pencils at him. He says, you know, there was nothing rational about throwing pencils at him. He says it wasn't going to motivate him to try any harder. But, you know, he said that in neoclassical economics, he says rational choice has illuminated areas of vast behavior by stressing that we do our best to fulfill desires with the information and resources that are available. And that's what we do, is we tend to look around and go, well, you know, I think now, and I teach this in the initial workshop that we do for clients, how we tend to be driven so much by now. And one of the examples I like to give is, you know, what if you ask somebody, hey, what are you going to be like 10 years from now? They can't tell. They're like, well, I'm pretty much like I am right now. I'm going to have the same likes, dislikes. And you say, well, what were you like 10 years ago? Well, I was totally different. Well, we have a hard time thinking into the future. We just do. And so it's hard for people to actually plan for the future because they can't even think into it. They don't want to think about it. I want to think about now. I may not be here 10 years now. I may not be here 20 years from now. I don't want to think about it. I want to plan for it. It's too far away. So that's why a lot of people wait to actually save for retirement into their 50s. That's when they start getting really busy. And he said, you know, there's more to the story. Some behavior is for itself, and it has no other reason. And he gives an example. He said, you know, let's say that you have a woman and her husband is drowning in the river. And she's trying to decide whether to jump in and save him. She doesn't sit there and go, well, you know, I'll calculate the present value of the benefits I expect to derive from my husband if he lives without my help. And minus the probability that I'll drown while I'm doing this multiplied by the value I attribute to my own life. You know, no, she's going to jump in and save him. Why? Because she loves him, right? You know, hopefully that's the idea, right? And the thing is she's going to do something that has nothing to do with anything. It's motivated by love. And we do things for other reasons. We do things because we don't want to look stupid. We do things, you know, maybe we actually hide in action because we don't want to look dumb. Or we do something out of anger because we're, you know, we don't want to lose, or we feel like we're not enough or whatever. And then sometimes we do things just to save face. It has nothing to do with anything other than just because, right? Well, what does this have to do with investing? Well, it has everything to do with investing. You know, what happens is this. People care about challenges that are reasonably stimulating. And he gives the example of the Bible, for example. He talks about, in the Wall Street Journal, he says, Mr. Robb believes it was the Bible, specifically the tale of the Good Samaritan, that finally brought his mentor around. Is the Samaritan rational? And he said, no, Mr. Robb says, but neither is he irrational. And this is what we talk about in our finance. A lot of times what we're doing when we're making decisions, we are making decisions on investing. We're making decisions on planning on the future. And what I try to get people to do, and I was trying to get investment advisors, I was talking to investment advisors about this week too, is they were talking about their practices. And I said, stop thinking about you. Quit thinking about you. Get yourself totally immersed and enamored with what the client is going through and what they need and what they want. You're going to be fine. Totally get yourself focused on that. And I said, you know, so if you will do that, stop thinking. And this is the same thing with clients too, with the general public. Money is just a tool to express what you value. A lot of people, what they do is they think more and more and more and just try to gather more and more money, and that's what's going to make them happy. But you look around, look for yourself. You know that a lot of people that are super rich can be super unhappy. And what happens is that, you know, you go through these decisions about finance. And once you get people stop thinking about themselves, number one, there's less depression. A lot of times it can be really depressing always thinking about yourself. But if you start thinking, I was talking to somebody today about this, as a matter of fact, and I made a comment to him, and he goes, you know why I'm doing what I'm doing? He says, because he was talking about work, how he worked and how he was starting to get a little bit bored with some of the things that he's doing. And he says, you know what? I'm an example to my kids. And I said, that's really good. Start thinking in that way, because what it'll do, it'll light your fire again for what you do when you stop thinking about you and your benefits and all of that and what your kids see. Because your kids are watching you all the time. And how you impact them can be life-changing for them. You know, how you handle money. My father would sit around the kitchen table. He'd be balancing his checkbook. He'd be thinking about his finances. And he would be, and I was watching my father be really, really, he was being really responsible. And I learned from watching him. I learned how he was always, you know, he was saving and he wasn't wasting money. And you know, you learn by watching others, but he was doing it just because he thought, this is what my son needs to see. And to me, that's fascinating, because we always think that we're always self-centered. But, you know, some of the best outcomes in life, and a really good book about this, is it's about how Scrooge, you know, the lessons you can learn from Scrooge. And I'll talk about that more in later shows. But, you know, it's just fascinating watching how people handle these psychological decisions and how big of an impact it can have on their financial future. To think not necessarily all about yourself, not all about your situation, but think how you can leave, you know, legacies and how you can help others and think of what you want your life to be 20 years from now, 30 years from now, if you're already in retirement, what your life can be like now. Money is just a tool to express what you value. And a lot of times what we do is we try to get more and more and more of it, but it's not necessarily going to be that thing that gives us the greatest happiness. Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show. You never thought you'd hear that on a financial show, did you? I'm Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show. Be right back after this on Supertalk 99.7 WTN. They told me, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum, a newborn king to see, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum. Our finest gifts we bring, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum. And I'm back here on the Investor Coaching Show. My wife sent me some kind of a video. It was doing the Little Drummer Boy. It was a modern version. Good night. What a light show. I don't know, Brian, if you saw, I don't know if you saw that at all, but good grief, that was on, some kind of country Christmas show or something like that. Those guys looked like they were having a big time. All right. So let's say, one of the things that people are dealing with right now, getting ready for retirement, and one of the things that we have been doing a lot of, and one of the things that I think that you ought to be aware of when you're preparing for retirement, a lot of times people get really close to retirement, and there are things that they don't do that they don't know that they can do. Number one, Social Security, how you actually file for it is a big deal. You know, who files first, husband, wife, which order do you file in, and you know, if you're able to do restricted filing, you know, some people are still able to do that for a while, and you know, how you actually take your benefits can be a really big deal. But here's another thing that people don't really necessarily think a lot about is, number one, think about Roth conversions when you're getting into retirement. If, and this is a common question that comes up, is what is your tax bracket right now versus what is your likely bracket down the road? Now, a lot of people are concerned that 2025. Tax laws will change back to what they were before. You know, some of the lower tax brackets will go away or they'll go up again, and increases may be down the road. It's hard to really predict the future when it comes to that. But if for some reason you think that you're in a lower bracket, and this can very much happen in your early years of retirement, you know, let's say that you quit work at age 65, let's say. Let's just say you quit work at age 65 and you decide, well, you know, I got a bunch of money in savings and I want to live off of some of that money in savings and then put off taking your Social Security so that you get the increase 8% per year from 66 to age 70 and just slightly under 8% the year before that from 65 to 66. What you can do is you can say, well, I'm going to put off Social Security so I get a much higher benefit for life, so I've got more guarantees in my life, and then I'll take the benefit later on. How am I going to, between now, if I'm retired at 65 to 70? Well, if you have regular savings, and after-tax savings works really, really well if people have built this up. And if you're younger, good reason to actually have what we call a non-qualified account. Matter of fact, when I put money in a 401k, I put everything I can in the 401k, and then what I do after that, for me personally, is I put money in a non-qualified account. And that what that does is gives me flexibility because it's taxed at capital gains rates, which historically have been lower than regular tax rates, but it also allows me to pull that money out, and a lot of it's already been taxed, so my tax bracket ends up being much, much lower. Well, what that allows me to do, because I'm living off of savings, it allows me to do conversions over into Roth IRAs. When I do those conversions, I have to pay taxes, but then the money is tax-free forever from that point on. Now, the benefit is this. When you get to age 70, you start taking your required distributions from your 401k or your IRAs, your pre-tax accounts, and you start paying taxes on those pre-tax accounts. Well, there's less money there, so there's less money that has to come out. Because there's less money that has to come out, you can get a situation, it just depends on your financial situation, how much money you've got in the accounts and what the rest of your income situation looks like. You can have a situation where you can have little or no taxes on your Social Security. And another thing is also Medicare premiums. Because Medicare premiums are based on income, you can reduce the Medicare premiums on your on the cost that comes out of pocket there. Then the other thing that you can do is this. You can be pulling money out in retirement, and then when you're going to jump into a higher bracket because of the income that you're getting from various sources, well, now you got Roth IRAs that you can pull money from and avoid paying taxes on that. And the other thing that you can think about is this, is being able to pass assets to heirs. That's another, you know, I was talking about in the previous segment, you know, doing things and why we do things and, you know, maybe thinking a little bit beyond, you know, your own situation, but, you know, thinking life holistically and everybody and what are the bigger meanings behind money? Because a lot of people, the bigger meaning behind money for them is, you know, their kids' legacy, you know, people that they want to help and charities that they want to help and things that they want to do. Well, you know, if you do some planning on this, it can be really, really helpful to next generations and future generations. And, you know, you have a lot of people, if you look at studies of people in their 90s and you ask them if you could live your life over again, what was one of the biggest things that they came out with? Was that they would do something that survived beyond them. You know, so that allows thinking in that particular area. So this is something we do in the planning process. Now, some people, you know, it's really, you know, they're just trying to make it in retirement. And you may actually do a whole different way of planning for the person just trying to make it versus the other person that says, no, I've got more than enough. I'm trying to do all of these other things. So that's where planning, really getting to know what it is that you want to do for us is really, really important, because the more we know about what you want to do, what you want to accomplish, the better. Now, the other thing that you do in planning is this, and this is something that takes software to do. But there's this idea of probability analysis. And the idea is that if I know what asset mix I have, how much I have in various areas of the market, I would know, based on history, what the expected return is of the portfolio and how much the return might vary from the expected return on a year-by-year basis. Now, if I know those numbers, and I know what those numbers are, what I can do is I can get a good idea is as to if we're likely to be successful being able to take the income that we want to take. And then, you know, the other thing that you do is thinking in terms of, you know, maybe in your early retirement, you may be spending a whole lot more money. So you got to look at that. You know, what if when I first retire, I'm living at a much higher level of income because I want to go and travel, I want to do things, I want to spend time with grandkids, and I want to do all these things, and later on I don't feel like doing those things. Well, you can actually play around with that. So just knowing those types of planning tools are out there, I think, is really important. But, you know, I thought that just giving you that one of those strategies toward the end of the year, it's a good strategy that we use often with clients, you know, that are in retirement, looking at conversions and looking at what am I taking and paying the taxes at now versus what likely I'll be pulling the money out in the future. If you're likely to be in a higher bracket in the future, that can be really good. If you're going to be likely in a lower bracket in the future, it may not be such a good idea. So you may want to just, you know, put your fingers in your ear and go la 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 and say, I just forget about everything I said, because Roth conversions, what you're looking at is whether you or somebody that takes the money later is likely to be in a higher bracket than you are right now. That's where those types of conversions make sense. And the other thing to think about this time of year too, we'll think about before, if you're taking required minimum distributions, is also considering QCDs, qualified charitable distributions, which is where you have the check come out of your IRA, the required minimum distribution, and have it written straight to the charity of your choice. You know, so people will go and take the required minimum distribution, and they say, well, I don't need all this money. I just need part of it, and I want to give to the charity. And they're doing standard deduction, and because they can't write off charitable donations in a standard deduction, they're doing the check straight to the charity, and so that they're still getting the benefit of the charitable contribution. So something just good to keep in mind when it comes down to it. Take a quick break and be right back after this. You're listening to the Investor Coaching Show right here on Super Talk 99.7 WTN.
Angels we have heard on high, sweetly sing.
All right, back here on the Investor Coaching Show, Paul Winkler talking about the world of money investing and talking about, this is interesting, the GDP. Now, you remember a few years back, our president at the time, Obama, had made a comment that GDP is just, we're not going to get a growth rate at 3% plus. We're just not going to get there anymore. It's just not the type of economy. Well, the Wall Street Journal actually had an article that said maybe we actually do have a GDP that's much bigger than we think it is. This is fascinating. GDP does not include proceeds of crime. Should it? When the U.S. calculates its gross domestic product, it only includes things that are legal. But if wares of drug dealers, pimps and bookies, and black market denizens were included, the GDP would expand by more than 1%, according to one estimate. Reminds me of Art Laffer. You know, he had the Laffer curve, and those of you familiar with that, he basically said that if we would reduce tax rates, people would come out of the woodwork and they'd start paying taxes again, because, you know, they don't have to avoid taxes anymore because the tax rates are reasonable and low, and we would actually have an increase in revenue. Probably not illegal activities, though. They probably won't come out of the woodwork with that. Highly doubtful. When the U.S. calculates this GDP, it only includes things that are legal. And if they actually included other stuff, it would be 1% increase. Now, it would also align with our national accounts with more closely with those of the European Union, whose members already incorporate some illegal activities in their tallies. Isn't that comforting? That Europe is doing so bad just to make themselves look better that they actually are including this stuff in their data, right? Countries all over the world measure the size and structure of the economies based on international standards published by the United Nations, known as a System of National Accounts, or SNA. Now, in the UK, it's estimated that prostitution and illegal drugs represent around 0.4% of GDP. In the U.S., Rachel Solovechek, a research economist with the Bureau of Economic Analysis, has estimated that in 2017, illegal activities would have added more than 1% to GDP. Presented her analysis last month in the IMF Statistical Forum. And it's just fascinating that somebody is even trying to figure that out. But, you know, what on earth does any of that matter? Well, you know, I think a lot of that matters because we're trying to take formally things that are illegal and add them to the legal. I was actually having a conversation with somebody, and they are in the business and dealing with greenhouses. Business is absolutely thriving. Why? Because marijuana, right? You know, people are, and who have been the biggest benefactors of that whole thing? And it's, I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, but here it is almost, it's like the gold rush. And it was one of those things that I had to talk people, so many people down in speeches that I was giving around town where they would ask me, it was almost like clockwork. Paul, should I be investing in marijuana stocks? Should I be investing in this? You know, should I be doing, you know, getting cannabis companies or whatever? And I would say, no, 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 no. And they'd be like, why this is going to be legal, it's going to be great and everything. And I would hearken back to the gold rush. In the gold rush, it was not the companies that were out there or the people out there going and looking for gold that did really, really well. It was people selling the implements to go and dig for the gold, you know, the picks, the axes, the shovels, and the wagons and all this stuff. That those are the people that made out like bandits in reality. And you know, it's just the same thing. We're seeing this trying the fight for legalization over here, and it's like that with other areas too. And I've often talked about where people will make the mistake of looking for technologies that are going to be big in the future, and they will say, "Hey, this is going to be great. This is going to be wonderful." And I always say, "Don't get overly hyperly focused, you know, on the company that's going to have the first flying car." There's another video about that this week in the Wall Street Journal. We're getting closer, folks. We are getting a lot closer to flying cars. Vertical takeoff, you don't need hardly any space to land. Fascinating stuff. But don't look at those companies. Look at how overall society is going to benefit from these things. Look at how people use the cell phone. It wasn't the cell phone inventor that actually benefited the most from the cell phone. It was the end user. With the digital camera manufacturer or inventor that benefited most from the digital camera. It was the end user. And that's the broad economy. That's why it's so important to stay really broadly diversified. Paul Winkler, Investor Coaching Show, SuperTalk 99.7 WTN.
Hope you enjoyed this week's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there. And if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Till next week, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.